Hello, I'm Richard Penson, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for joining us for today's podcast entitled Who, What, and Why of Biomarker Testing in Ovarian Cancer. Today's program is supported by a joint educational grant from AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals and Merck & Co. Incorporated of Rahway, New Jersey, USA. I'm Richard Penson, a physician at Mass General Brigham and associate professor at Harvard Medical School. And I'm also the IRB chair at the Dana-Farber Harvard Cancer Center in Boston. And I am delighted to welcome a very good colleague, Antonio Gonzalez Martin, MD, PhD. Welcome, Antonio.
Hi, Richard. Thank you for having me in this conversation. I'm very excited for
Exciting
that.
times. Antonio is the director of the Cancer Center Clinica Universidad de Navarra, Madrid, Spain. So before we begin, I'd like to repeat our learning objective, which is to assess the significance of HRD positivity in the first-line treatment of ovarian cancer. Antonio, give us a bit of historical background. Within the field of gynecological oncology, what drew you to the very prominent position you have as one of the leaders of the upfront studies?
So thank you, Richard, for this question, because honestly, when I look back and I remember the earlier times in which we treat all the patients in the same way, we only had paclitaxel carboplatin for every single patient, regardless of the histology, regardless of the biomarker, regardless of the molecular subtype. And that was all the thing that we had. Even the distinction of the histology when we started was not so relevant as it is right now. So, but I think that all the medical oncologists from the beginning started to think that we need something to discriminate which patients are doing well, which patients are doing so bad, something is happening. How could we figure out when we treat a patient, which patient will survive, which patient will not, which patient need another therapy? So that was some sort of thoughts that we had from the early beginning, even before this exciting time of biomarkers in ovarian cancer.
Fabulous. Yeah. Armidosa's group from Canada recently wrote a really lovely review in one of the Nature journals. And it was a really helpful reminder that we have sort of eclipsed surgery as the focus. We've eclipsed stage as the focus. And it really is down to the inherited germline genetic milieu that the tumor develops in and those particular mutations or aberrations in the tumor that drive biology. So take us to a patient in your clinic in Madrid. How do you do testing for the patients in clinic, germline versus somatic testing?
Yeah, so that's also a nice question, because we have had in the last few years a lot of discussion on how to better optimize the testing of our patients with advanced ovarian cancer in frontline. So the point in which we are right now is that we are testing every single high-grade serous, high-grade endometrioid advanced ovarian cancer patient with HRD testing using the SOPHiA GENETICS platform. That includes also BRCA testing, BRCA1 and BRCA2 testing in the tumor, and a few other genes that are CCNE1, BRIP, RAD51C, RAD51D, PALB2, and probably another one that I don't remember right now. But essentially, we test the tumor first. In case that we have a mutation in BRCA1 or BRCA2, then we order the germline testing. Honestly, we have had a lot of discussion, because we know that other guidelines and in other parts of the world, they start with the genetic germline testing, or even they perform both at the same time. The final decision that we made was based on the PAOLA-1 analysis of the French samples. Just to remind the audience, PAOLA-1 is a trial that randomized advanced high-grade or endometrioid ovarian cancer at the end of chemotherapy plus bevacizumab to olaparib 2 years or placebo 2 years, along with the bevacizumab. All the patients I participated in this trial, I put several patients, all the patients need to provide tumor that was sent for central testing of BRCA and HRD. The French investigators in Paola perform the correlation between the BRCA results in tumor and BRCA results in the germline testing. And honestly, they test approximately around 400 patients, 350, or in between 350 and 400 patients. And the only, if I remind well, only one patient had BRCA while BRCA germline positive, but was BRCA tumor negative. So there are other authors that have provided a rate of false positive in the tumor of up to 3%, but at least in our media, we consider acceptable this is less than 1%. So that's, sorry for this long response, but that's why we prefer to start with the tumor determination.
Yeah, and I think it tells you more. In Solo 3, which is late line therapy using olaparib, 3% of patients at presentation into the trial had a reversion mutation, so loss of some eloquent gene mutation that confers an advantage can really be significant, and that substantially increased over time. And so to know what's going on in the tumor is really important. But I think it's probably true to say, do comment on this in a second, that in contrast to the POLE carrying endometrial cancer mutations, where a P53 mutation often means very little, it's a passenger mutation as a tumor develops with so much chaotic mutation that these patients do extraordinarily well. Generally, the somatic versus germline finding a BRCA 1 or 2 mutation really carries the same weight in terms of a better outcome and a better response to switch maintenance PARP inhibitor therapy.
That's absolutely right. Testing the tumor, you capture approximately 10% more patients with BRCA mutation that do not have the germline mutation. And that's why we prefer to test the tumor, because at least in our experience, roughly 25% of patients will have the BRCA mutation in the tumor, but not all of them will be for sure germline BRCA mutated. So that's a great also comment about the relevance of the behavior of BRCA mutated tumor, which is exactly the same that the germline mutated, for the outcome and the predictive factor for PARP inhibitor efficacy.
Yeah, there was a lovely science paper a few years ago that suggested the late development of a BRCA mutation as an acquired somatic alteration might make for a different genetic profile, but that's not been our clinical experience. So yeah, these are essentials to find. And is my understanding that you test everybody?
Yeah, absolutely. We test every single new patient with advanced ovarian cancer, with advanced high-grade endometrioid or serous ovarian cancer. In the early stages, we perform the germline, because that in that stages, we don't have the approval for PARP inhibitors. So what is important for these patients is to know if there is a germline mutation for the genetic counseling. And that's why...
Sorry, keep going.
No. That's why we don't test for tumor in these early stages.
Right. Do you include stage 2 in advanced in Europe?
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
To be completely honest, stage 2 is a gray zone. We know perfectly that these patients have a high risk of relapse, and there are some voices in favor of treating like advanced stage. But in Europe, we consider stage 1 and 2 as early stage.
Early stage, right. So So you do your testing, and then one of the challenges that we've had is that half our patients now, Alex Melamed was the senior author on a publication just that came out on this in Clinical Cancer Research, that we've gone up from 16 to 42% of our patients doing neoadjuvant chemotherapy in the USA, not just at Mass General
Yeah.
Hospital. And so not unusually, a cytologic diagnosis, primary chemotherapy as neoadjuvant treatment before interval cytoreductive surgery. And fully in 10% of our patients, there's not enough tumor at debulking or effete dead tumor so that we don't get a result. So we actually miss out on the HRD testing in 10%. And so we are rethinking laparoscopic staging at the beginning and three cores from interventional radiology so that we have the material to make the right decisions for patients.
Yeah, that's I think it's a key comment, Richard. Actually, we change our practice. We change our practice in our institution once we realize how important is testing HRD in the primary tumor before treatment. Before that, that change in our practice, biopsy, core biopsy in case of a stage four that will never go to primary debulking surgery, or a stage three that will never go for primary surgery, was considered enough in our institution, was considered sufficient, but was considered sufficient for diagnosis, but not for testing. Sometimes there is not enough tumor, and that's why we now do laparoscopy in all the patients, even if we are going to start with neoadjuvant chemotherapy, for two reasons. First, to have a good sample for the testing, a sufficient amount of tissue to avoid any sort of, as you said, impossibility of determination because of the amount of tumor cells. And second, because that is a complementary way to know how extensive is the disease, and another way to evaluate the response to neoadjuvant chemotherapy. But this is secondary in our perspective. The main reason was that. Let me share with you some information. When we did the PRIMA study and also in the PAOLA-1 study, the rate of patients in which the HRD was non-determined was roughly 16 to 18%, so which is quite high. Right now, in our experience and at the beginning of starting the HRD testing, we did it centralized in Spain. We realized that it is less than 10% for sure, and approximately 5 to 6%. So what has changed? My interpretation is that for the PRIMA and PAOLA, we had to provide the tissue that you had at that time. And what you mentioned is very important. When you have treated a patient with neoadjuvant chemotherapy and you operate the patient, if the patient has a CRS3 response to chemotherapy or a good CRS2, the amount of tissue that you are going to test is ridiculous. And then the possibility to test HRD is almost impossible. Or even if you provide only the biopsy of the beginning, that could be a small amount of tissue. So that's very important to have sufficient amount of tissue. That's why we recommend now laparoscopy, I would say even almost for every patient.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of merit to that, and unless it's of such sort of dire and emergent circumstances that you've got to get on with treatment, because it really is, it's an essential element of decision making to have that diagnostic ability.
Yeah.
I was I'm really pleased you brought it up, because when the paper came out instantly after ESMO 2024 about the PRIMA overall survival, in the appendix, you can pull up all this really valuable data, and I really hadn't appreciated that that group was half as big as the HRP, so homologous recombination proficient, and then 50% of that size, but another big group, homologous recombination not able to be done, and they did not perform well in the study. They were one of the
Yeah.
notable subsets who didn't seem to get much benefit from switch maintenance PARP inhibitor therapy. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I analyzed in detail this group of patients because that is a subgroup of a subgroup at the end of the day. But what I realize is that half of those patients are stage four. And I think stage four is a big thing, and that includes a stage four A with some pleural effusion and as in a small supraclavicular lymph node, or even extensive liver or pulmonary disease. And when you start to see that there are imbalance in this group compared with the global population, a subgroup, it's difficult. I think it's pure by chance. It's pure by chance that the hazard ratio was against neuropathy in that case. No explication that group doesn't do well.
I completely agree. I think it's too risky to generate hypotheses from that subgroup of a subgroup. But it reminds us again that increasingly we are dividing patients at presentation into ever increasingly small groups of ever increasingly important determinants of outcome. And so knowing the granular nature of what's going on in a specific patient is really important. I was really fascinated with a paper that came out recently, the real world variation in maintenance duration from Hagstrom this year, October 2024, and a staggeringly large number of clinicians were using 5 years or more or indefinite treatment for platinum-sensitive recurrent ovarian cancer. And so I was one of the very early adopters of doing 2 or 3 years of PARP inhibitor at any time that you're using it. And so in that context, when there's still a sense that for some patients, like in Oreo, where there's 10% of the patients who have an extraordinary benefit for a very durable period of time, it's very tempting to continue treatment of these patients. So give us a little historical, personal insight to how you as investigators chose the 3 years of switch maintenance in PRIMA.
That's another very important question. Just to put in context, when we designed the PRIMA study, was the time in which the PARP inhibitors came up in the second line, showing an incredible benefit in progression-free survival. And at that time, the PARP inhibitor was used anti-progression in that population. We included in PRIMA the population with the highest risk of relapse, so essentially stage four, and patients with a stage three and residual tumor after primary debulking surgery, or any patients receiving neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So those are the patients with their clinical characteristics of high risk. That is not like the platinum-sensitive relapse, but is the group of patients that do have the higher risk of relapse. So that was one of the reasons why the treatment of neuropathy was designed to be, or was scheduled to be, longer than. In a context in which you consider that the patient can be already be cured with surgery plus chemo, and the maintenance can be shorter. That's the case, for instance, in SOLO-1 or in PAOLA-1. SOLO-1 is a study that is unique because approximately two-thirds of the patients receive primary debulking surgery. And of them, 75% had complete cytoreductive surgery. So those patients are the patients that we can cure and that we should not expose for a longer time to the PARP inhibitor. So now, with the perspective of the time, we realize that probably 2 years of niraparib in the initial designs probably could be the same. Actually, the Nirvana study, that is a study for stage three patients, completely cytoreductive, that is randomizing niraparib versus niraparib plus bevacizumab, the duration of niraparib is only 2 years. So obviously there is a discussion about the duration. The label is what it is. The design was based on that, as I said, the use of PARP inhibitors in second line, I would say mainly.
Yeah. Tell us a bit more about Cure, because I think one of the things that people may not appreciate is that in Solo 1, which was 2 years of olaparib, switch maintenance therapy after first line therapy, the overall survival curves really separate just after 4 years. Up until that point, there's not a big difference. And then there's a huge difference, 45% better overall survival at 7 years. And my favorite statistician, mathematician is Rob Coleman, and he's estimated from that data that we are really not going to know. You know, again, that wasn't statistically significantly different because of the alpha spend. We're not going to know till like 15 to 17 years out in that patient group whether patients are truly cured. Late recurrences just to, you know, all this continue to be a threat. When you talk to a patient who's had an optimally cyto-reduced advanced ovarian cancer, Carrizo BRCA mutation, and gets 2 years of olaparib, you presumably are, there's a strong expectation of cure.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So I want to see also, Richard, what is the rate of progression-free survival at 5 years of the studies? That is a very important hint in my view of what is going to happen in that population. Because the overall survival can be influenced by many reasons, and many things are around overall survival. But to be alive and without progression at 5 years, I think it's a good predictor of cure. Because with the PARP inhibitors, we have seen that the curves reach some sort of plateau. And between 3 and 4 years, and 4 years and 5 years, we have lower and lower rate of relapse. And what we have seen in Solo One, I mean, Paola, for the HRDs, that in the whole population, approximately 50% of patients have not relapsed at 5 years. And it is interesting because 2 years ago, I presented in ESMO GYN a concept that was called the conditional probability of survival that was applied to PRIMA. Essentially, that means that what is the probability of relapse if after 1 year of treatment you have not had a relapse? What is the probability of relapse if after 2 years you have not had a probability of relapse? What is the probability in the next year? And that probability is becoming lower and lower. So the longer is the time that you are alive, the lower is the probability to relapse. So we haven't had that analysis of the people that reach 5 years without relapse in the PARP inhibitor trials. But my prediction is that probably is very, 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 very few rates of relapse. And yeah, that's important.
Yeah.
We think we can cure patients nowadays with the addition of PARP inhibitors, but it's very important to have an optimal surgery from the beginning also, because that's a group in which we can have more influence.
Yeah, and exciting to hear about Nirvana as a trial trying to do that very same thing. So nice to see bevacizumab included in something to optimize treatment to try and get people cured, because it tends to be used for stage 4 disease in the USA. So give us a primer on PRIMA. Just remind us about PRIMA and Paola 1 in their design, and with the data that Brad Monk presented at ESMO 2024, give us sort of a cross trial comparison of those two trials.
Okay, so regarding design, the main difference between both trials, I would say, is first, in Paola 1, patients receive chemo plus bevacizumab, and in the maintenance, they continued bevacizumab and were randomized to olaparib 2 years or placebo in a 2-to-1 ratio. In the PRIMA, we include only patients with high risk, as I mentioned before, first thing. And second thing, the randomization was also 2-to-1 to niraparib 4 placebo. So the control arm was pure placebo. Also, the duration has been already mentioned. And Paola 1 was 2 years in the of olaparib, and in Prima it was 3 years of the niraparib. Essentially, the primary endpoint of both trials was progression-free survival, and both trials were positive for the primary endpoint. In Prima, we analyzed in a hierarchical way, first in the HRD and then in the intent to treat. HRD positive patients had a hazard ratio, final hazard ratio of 0.51, and the global population had a hazard ratio of 0.66. In the Paola one, they performed the intent to treat analysis for the overall population that was positive, and then a pre-planned exploratory analysis showed that benefit was restricted to the HRD positive patients. So in the HRD negative patients, the addition of olaparib to bevacizumab did not improve the progression-free survival. The studies are difficult to compare, essentially, because the population is not the same. But Dr. Ketaloruso published this year in the International Journal of Gynecological Cancer the analysis of Paola 1 according to the patient characteristics risk, dividing patients in something like a Prima-like population and the lower high-risk population, that is a stage 3 with optimal cytoreduction. And it is interesting to see how the for instance, the progression-free survival at 5 years in both trials, in Prima and Paola 1 trial, for this high-risk population is exactly the same. It's 35% of patients are alive without progressions at 5 years. And when you see also the overall survival at 5 years, the experimental arm of both studies reach similar results, which is approximately 55% of overall survival at 5 years. So that's, again, a message of the importance of the surgery in the first line from my perspective. And secondly, I think that we have two options for our patients, olaparib plus bevacizumab or niraparib alone. And our challenge in the clinic is how to select the treatment for the patients according to the patient characteristics nowadays.
One of the things, again, people may not be aware of a subtle difference in eligibility criteria. In Prima, patients had to have either a complete response in the marker or a 90% reduction and no progression, no elevation of the CA125 for at least in the next sample. And I've always been curious about whether you particularly selected a group of patients with really effective apoptotic machinery, you know, platinum sensitivity. And so riding that sort of distillation of patients who you'll be able to demonstrate a progression-free survival, you know, maybe more than an overall survival. And do you think that enrichment of that particular group of patients maybe sort of a tip towards PFS rather than the patients who could be cured, like you said, from, you know, the sort of surgical, primary surgical debulking and optimal cytoreduction?
So my interpretation is that the high-risk population, according to clinical factors, influenced the progression-free survival, that if you see is shorter than in other studies, but the high selection of patients according to the platinum sensitivity, as you mentioned, is influencing the response to subsequent therapies. And that's why the global overall survival was longer in comparison with the globally shorter progression-free survival in the PRIMA study across the different biomarker subgroups. But the overall survival was long. And we have not demonstrated a difference in overall survival in the long term. And one of the reasons could be this highly selection of patients according to the platinum sensitivity that you mentioned, that the one of the hypotheses that I have.
I mean, I wonder, it's again, like we said, the subset analysis, you have to be a bit careful, the nuances, how trials load patients, their outcome for frontline therapy, selection of endpoints, those sorts of things. It's one of the things that I find so frustrating is we can't demonstrate much of a difference in quality of life on PARP inhibitors, which has always been absolutely staggering. There's no doubt when you see patients in clinic that nausea, fatigue, and fear of recurrence sort of have an effect on quality of life, but boy, it's hard to demonstrate that in formal measures.
But on the other hand, we know and we have provided data in the PRIMA study that when the patient relapse, that is what really deteriorate the quality of life of the patients. So that's why, although we know that the patient has to pay something for the PARP inhibitors, that is, as you mentioned, some nausea, essentially first weeks, as fatigue or asthenia is longer, the anemia that sometimes they need transfusion. But to keep the patients alive without progression is at the end of the is at the end of the day is good because the
The best
worst thing
quality of
is
life.
is the relapse is.
Yeah, I haven't really seen a good twist analysis, time without symptoms from treatment or symptoms from progression of disease that really sort of separates those two. But it is, I completely agree with you in terms of what happens in clinic. So thank you for all you've contributed to, the development of these upfront studies, the transformation of care. Just give us a quick overview of how you do the biomarker testing in anticipation for those who are going to have a recurrence, folate receptor, HER2, immunohistochemistry for mismatch repair. What's your strategy for patients?
So our strategy is when the patient has the first relapse, we test for HER2 immunohistochemistry according to the gastric protocol, and we do an NGS with 500 genes. Is the Oncomine, the Thermo Fisher solution. That is what we are doing in our institution. So far, we have not started to test folate receptor alpha. We have recently received the EMA approval. We are in the process of the negotiation in our country for the reimbursement. And in the meantime, we are preparing all the procedures just to test the folate receptor alpha. Probably we will start with some sort of centralization as it happened initially in the States. And then once the pathologists became comfortable and they can provide reliable data on folate receptor alpha expression, probably that will have some sort of widespread use in our country. But I guess that we will start in few sites testing for folate receptor alpha.
Right. Well, it's great that that's coming. And sometimes it's a tragedy to see how slow these things transform into access for patients. It's quite a big one of the hot topics at the moment is that ultra low HER2 expression in breast cancer really seems to be conferring a big advantage for some antibody drug conjugates. So our sense is that there's going to be creep in terms of how people use ADCs, which are really taking off in the US.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's interesting, even in the development of new ADCs and the HER2. I'm participating in a trial, and the cohorts of the 2+, 3+, and 1+ are already closed, and there is a zero HER2 possible HER2 negative patients cohort now enrolling patients just to figure out if even those patients
I think
are
in breast cancer,
benefiting.
they don't call them zero, they call them ultra low. But yeah, I hear you, that same group of patients. Yeah, fantastic. So, just to summarize, and now we're in an era where everybody has to be tested for these crucial biomarkers. They not only illuminate prognosis, but they are predictive of really substantial benefit to have a 45% improvement in the chance of being alive at 7 years with olaparib in an upfront therapy based on SOLO-1 is just extraordinary. And it's been our privilege, Antonio and mine, to be involved in these trials, which is excellent. Unfortunately, it's our time to wrap up our discussion. Can I encourage you to be part of this as we roll on to new trials, and do encourage your participants to participate. To receive CME and CEE credit for today's program, complete the post-test and evaluation. You'll be able to download and print your certificate immediately upon completion. Remember, this is a podcast series on gynecological cancers, and next month we'll be hosting a discussion on unraveling the options in first-line maintenance for ovarian cancer, and I hope you'll be able to join us. We'll be archiving this and future podcasts in this series on the Oncology Hub at cmeoutfitters.com, where you can also find a number of excellent resources for clinicians and patients. And again, thank you, Antonio.
It was a great honor to be part of this series of podcasts and to have this discussion with you, Richard. Always a privilege to learn from you. Thank you.
Thank you, Antonio, for joining us for this very important discussion. And thank you to you, our audience, for tuning in today and for providing the very best care for patients with ovarian cancer.